We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
A Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 12, Harry and Aeneas in the Underworld. Us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Vasiliki Panoussi about how Harry's experiences in Deathly Hallows reference Aeneas's underworld journey in Virgil's Aeneid. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today we're going to talk about a variety of deathly experiences Harry has in that last book that parallel the ancient Roman text, the Aeneid. Emily, when you think about Book 7, what deathly scenes particularly stand out to you?
There's one I use when I teach, and I am teaching about Christian notions of the connectedness between the living and the dead because of shared faith in Christ. And so I show the scene from the film, which I actually think is a little better for my purpose, in my class, of when Harry releases the resurrection stone from the snitch, and then his loved ones appear to him, spoiler alert, and they say, he says, "Why are you here?" And his mother, Lily, in the film, I think it's a little different in the book, but in the film she says, "We never left." And this is just always like so moving to me personally as a Christian. And it helps to drive the point home to my students of, you know, the way Christians think about the afterlife and how, you know, in Catholicism, we say, you know, death is not life ended, but just life changed.
So I thought you were going to say just the next great adventure. I fill in Dumbledore's words when you say
right.
that. So
right,
I'm surprised. Exactly. I thought you were going to say, Dobby and Harry burying Dobby.
This article has really made me think a little differently about that. Not totally differently, but I'm excited to talk about it. What about you?
Yeah.
What about deathly scenes for you?
Yeah, well, for me, it's really all about Dobby, as you know. Then, of course, you have to think, I think also about that, like that weird space of King's Cross with Dumbledore at the end. And, you know, there's something interesting that's going on there it's not death, but it is death, you know, in that weird way that it's both things and neither at the same time.
Liminal.
Yes, right. And so I'm excited to see sort of where we can see some like classical references. We know that J.K. Rowling was herself a student of classical studies. And so she very likely is, you know, this is part of what's in her creative stew. So I'm excited about this. So without further ado, we are very pleased to have joining us today Dr. Vasiliki Lily Panoussi, Chancellor Professor of Classical Studies at William & Mary. Lily is the author of Virgil's Aeneid and Greek Tragedy, Ritual, Empire, and Intertext from Cambridge University Press, 2009, and Brides, Mourners, Bacchae, Women's Rituals in Roman Literature from Johns Hopkins University Press in 2019. Most recently, she has co-edited a collection of essays entitled Emotional Trauma in Greece and Rome, Representations and Reactions from Routledge 2020. Her works in progress include a book on the role of the Egyptian goddess Isis in Roman literature and articles on the reception of classical myths in children's and young adult literature and pop culture. Today we'll be talking with her about her article in The Lion and the Unicorn from 2019 entitled Harry's Underworld Journey, Reading Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Through Virgil's Aeneid. Welcome to the show, Lily.
Hello, everybody. I'm delighted to be here.
How is Greece right now?
It's very hot.
Hot.
I am very lucky that I am close to the water. And so I take advantage of some of the wonderful breeze that we get here. And I am lucky.
Oh, that's nice.
It's great weather for swimming.
Yeah, that just seems like a wonderful place to spend the summer, even though I get that it's hot. Yeah.
It gets hot. Yeah.
Well, how did you first become interested in Harry Potter as a subject for analysis, especially from your perspective as a scholar of classical literature?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. You know, I first became interested in the Harry Potter novels just because I wanted to know what the fuss was about. And at the time, I had an academic leave, so I had time to actually read books. And so I started reading them, and I loved them. They were so fun. But I think even from the first few chapters that I read, it was so clear that, you know, classical literature was a huge influence on the novel. Mm-hmm. I mean, even from the very first one, The Sorcerer's Stone, you know, it just became so fun to try to see, you know, what is she going to do next? And so every book became, you know, it became clear that this was a deeper, you know, engagement with the classical world, not just a perfunctory one.
I was just going to say, you were kind of able to anticipate that she was going to keep using some of these and keep delving into the classical motifs and so on.
Exactly. And I was just curious to see what she was going to do with it. And I have to say that it was only when I read the Deathly Hallows, like the last book, that I was like, oh my God, she's doing the Aeneid. So, and this article, I had it in me for a long time. I wanted to write it for a really long time. But you know, because it's not in my main area of expertise, I never really had the time. And it was only in 2017, when I had another sabbatical, that I said, you know, I could do this now. I can actually get it done. And I wrote it in a month. I mean, it just came out of me.
It was really
funny. Like, I have never written an article that quickly. But as I'm sure you know, it takes, you know, years to sometimes to write an article. Mm-hmm. And in any event, I had it for a long time in my head and my heart. And I was very happy when it came out. It was one of the most, most self-satisfying moments, you know, having this come out.
Oh, yeah. And I really very much enjoyed it. Really, really neat article.
Yeah. It was great. It was great. Full of insights.
Thank you.
So the Aeneid is very famous, but we don't want to assume that everybody knows what's in it. So will you give our listeners just a little idea of what this text is about and what its significance is in Western literature?
So the Aeneid was written in the first century BC, BCE. So upon its first arrival into the world, when the first few people read it, recognized it as an incredibly important text that was going to, you know, make a huge impact in the world of the time. And the text is actually about the Trojan hero Aeneas, who is one of the princes of Troy. He's a cousin of Hector, and his mother is Venus, and his father is immortal Anchises. The story tells how Aeneas escaped from Troy. He went through various voyages and troubles, and ends up in Italy, where he founds a new city, which eventually will become Rome. So for the Romans, this was a poem that was trying to go back to their beginnings, right? To create a myth, a story about their arrival into the world scene. And by basing that story on the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, Virgil tried to say that now we, the Romans, have an equivalent, important literary work that identifies us as a people. An additional sort of bonus that Virgil had to work with was that by being the son of Venus, Aeneas was related to the current leader of Rome, who was Augustus Caesar. Julius Caesar, his adopted father, traced his lineage to the goddess Venus. And so by having Aeneas as the hero, Virgil was able to tie very neatly the origins of Rome with the current leader of Rome that was going to end the civil wars that were plaguing the city and of course the empire at the time, and usher in a new era of peace and stability and prosperity and all that good stuff. When Virgil, Virgil was writing this poem for 10 years, as far as we know, and in from 29 BCE to 19 BCE. And at that time, he decided to stop writing and then go to Greece and research, go to some of the places and so on and so forth. But then, unfortunately, during that trip, we hear that he got sick and had to, shorten the trip, come back, and then he died in Italy. The story goes that on his deathbed, because he hadn't put the finishing touches, he asked for it to be burned. And that moment,
talk about a perfectionist.
Well, we don't know if the story is totally true, but assuming that it is, that's how it goes. His friend Augustus sort of overruled him, and his two friends, Varius and Tacca, they edited a little bit, just cleaned it up, and then published it. And they did this because it was deemed as super significant even at that time. And this is why I told you the story, to show you that everybody thought this was so significant. Now, that came true. It's true. It was incredibly significant. It became almost instantly a school book for kids in school, boys, of course, at the time. And it became the object of study, both from the, on the part, initially, of course, because it was like this great national poem, right? But then as time went by and as, Rome was no longer what it was, it became a very important philosophical and moral guide. People try to find Christian teachings in it, or teachings that would be okay with Christians. They thought that it was very important as an allegory. So it continued to be one of the central texts taught at schools throughout the late antiquity, Middle Ages, Renaissance, and early modern times. And of course, it generated an enormous amount of commentaries, of works that studied, analyzed, explained, and brought to life this text for school students throughout this time, for all these centuries. So its significance in Western literature has been enormous and really hard to explain in just a few minutes here. So
yes, no, that makes sense. I mean, I think number one, you've got a lot of the people who are your literate class who are reading it and analyzing it and also being inspired by it, probably in their own things that they're writing themselves. And so then it becomes something that you have to read as a way to understand the other literature that's out there as well, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. And so you would never have had Dante without Virgil and, the Inferno. You would never have had Milton's Paradise Lost. So there's so many. Dryden's translation of the Aeneid also initiated after that time, a huge engagement with it. So you have a lot of, the staples of, European literature and even early American literature, all owe a lot to the Aeneid.
So, do you think is Rowling just one of many people who are inspired by it? I mean, obviously she is, or is there some explicit reason that she wants to reference this particular work, do you think?
I think that she is interested in it as a text that is, very rich and interesting and of course an epic, right? Because she's also her books are an epic. It may not be in poetry, in poetic form, but it is an epic, right? You got the hero, he goes through adventures, he beats the bad guy, all of that stuff that's, you would consider an epic are there. And so I think as one of the most important epics is an obvious thing, the obvious text she would be looking at or thinking about. But I also think she has a greater reason, which is that she wants cheap, I think she asked, and I don't know that she had that ambition initially, and I really can't speak for her, right? I mean, I don't know. But I think as this Harry Potter thing took off and as more and more people were, as the madness happened, I think this became an opportunity for that epic to be a foundational epic of sorts, something that would help improve the world or have an impact on the real world in a way that literature usually does not, or other literature, I should say. And this is more along the lines of ancient texts, which had more direct channels to the, to executive power. They were, people like Virgil had, direct ties to Augustus.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that you get that all the politics that becomes more obvious as the books are coming along. And you make the point in the article that it's Harry's kind of also ushering in a new era, like Aeneas was, and seen as the foundation of a kind of new society that they're going to be able to build off of his success and his quest.
I think that is the ultimate goal that she has. She likes to see, the novels seem to be doing that. Yes.
In your article, you focus on the concept of catabasis. What is catabasis, and what does it mean when evoked in literature like the Aeneid and Harry Potter?
Catabasis is a Greek word. It means descent, going down, and it is used for the first time to describe Odysseus's journey to the underworld in Homer's Odyssey. The hero is imagined in antiquity, I should say, the underworld is under the earth, right? That's why it's an underworld. And therefore, in order to go to the underworld, you have to go down. And that's why it's called catabasis. After Homer, almost every single epic written ha included a catabasis scene, a scene where a hero would go to the underworld. So many myths also have this. So, for instance, Heracles goes to the underworld. Sorry, Theseus goes to the underworld. So basically, every self-respecting hero goes to the underworld, and therefore, Aeneas had to go to the underworld in that in the same
Right.
vein, and also Harry Potter. And I should say that in I focused on the Deathly Hallows, but there are catabasis in every single of the books.
Oh,
You've got
yes.
the Mirror of Erised in the first book. You've got, of course, the dungeons in the second book. In the third book, you've got the tree, which is again has this underworld, this
Oh,
underground
yeah.
scene where, right? And the fourth, of course, is the major where well, the graveyard where Voldemort is reborn.
Well, six is
So
the
it means
cave. Fifth is
it's the
the
day.
Department of
Yeah, it's
Mysteries.
the you've got, and then the Deathly Hallows, you've got a bunch of them, as you were saying before. So that's the meaning of it. And of course, the meanings are very rich, right? That you've got ideas of death and rebirth.
There's so many of these little intersections with the dead and departed heroes even. And this is definitely something that Aeneas is also experiencing. And you have connected Harry's underworld journey with a lot of the particular instances in Aeneas's journey as well, and particularly as Aeneas journeys through a city that embodies loss and grief, Buthrotum. How is Aeneas's experience in Buthrotum alluded to in the Deathly Hallows? Like, where do we see that parallel?
So Aeneas has, you know, Troy is burning. Aeneas leaves Troy. And then he has to wander a little bit. He doesn't really know where he should go or what he should do. So he's wandering about a bit.
That and sounds very familiar, all the wandering in the Deathly Hallows.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes. And so he ends up in this, on his way to wherever he's going, and he doesn't know where he's going yet. He makes a stop at the city of Buthrotum. And that city is described as a replica of Troy. So Trojan refugees have founded it, and the king is another cousin of his, Helenus, and he has married Andromache, the wife of Hector, that you may know from the Iliad. And so when Aeneas goes there, he's elated because he feels he's back home, right? That his home, which was destroyed, is alive again. And he sees his friends and he sees Andromache and they reminisce and they talk about the past. So it's all very, you know, very nice and heartwarming. But there's also a lot of, you know, problematic stuff going on, in the sense that Andromache has, he finds her the first time he sees her on the tomb of her son and husband, who were killed in the war. And of course, it's an empty tomb because their bodies were back in Troy. And she's there doing the burial rites again and again and again. She's remarried, but she's not, you know, she feels still married to her former husband. She doesn't have any other children. So it's a very, it's an experience anchored in the past and into the dead, right? To what is dead and gone, and clinging to it as if that is something that can be, you know, possessed or recaptured. And I think really quickly, Aeneas realizes that he cannot stay there. This is not what he should be. And of course, there's prophecies involved, which is, again, the same as, you know, in Harry Potter, there's some prophecies that kind of help him figure it out. And so he realizes he has to go. So Aeneas learned some lessons there, though. He understands that the past has to belong to the past, that he has to move on and, you know, have found a new city, try a new future. And that's kind of one of the ways in which we can see that experience Aeneas has there. Now, for Harry in the Deathly Hallows, I think his visit to his parents' grave, that is a similar experience. It is he goes there to see his parents, to be with them, right? And because that's where their bodies are, and to be with them. But when and he feels some pleasure in that, like Aeneas, you know, he feels some pleasure in being there, in imagining himself with his parents. There's a lot of positive, you know, feelings that and he feels a drawn to that place, right? I mean, would you agree?
Right.
Yes. I mean, Godric's Hollow, he's sort of, you know, it's this home that he never realized he had, in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah, he kind of harps on the other two to go there, you know, a lot earlier than they actually do. And, you know, Hermione says, no, that would be dangerous. And it's only when she, you know, says, oh, no, I think we're going to have to go there, you know, that they get to go. But it's definitely seems like a little bit of an indulgence for Harry.
Exactly. And that indulgence is actually something that is very typical of people who feel grief. There's a lot of ancient Greek and Latin narratives that point out to the dangers of that you could get lost in that grief. You could be consumed by it. Mm-hmm. Your desire to be with your loved one could make you want to die yourself. and all of these things, you know, so on the one hand, there's a lot of danger involved with that. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And I think that's what Hermione realizes, right? I mean, she may not realize it at the same level, but there is a danger in this dwelling, you know, on the past, in the way that Harry wants it. And I think that statue that he sees, that commemorative statue that he sees there, is another example of that, you know, pleasure in remembering the happiness and remembering that he didn't have the scar. I mean, he doesn't actually remember that, but he can, you know, he can indulge into the fantasy of this was my life. And he may not have actual memories of it, but he is. It allows him to fantasize about this happiness. And so, of course, he has to go. And he realizes it himself. Once he performs a kind of burial rite by putting the wreath. And I think the movie did this beautifully, how, you know, they created that wreath out of nowhere. He used his magic to put that wreath on and perform, you know, a burial rite that we would understand as a modern audience, you know, or readers, that gave him the kind of, you know, reminding him of that separation. He's living, they're dead, and that therefore he has to go back with the living. And I think that scene where he squeezes Hermione's hand, that is another, you know, her warm hand. He's, you know, they squeeze their hands. That, you know, the sense of touch is very important. She reminds us of Harry's, you know, he's a living person. He's not dead. He's not like his parents. So he has to depart from that place.
Yeah. And I do think that that whole part where they're in Godric's Hollow is such an important catalyst for the rest of what happens in the books in terms of, you know, like even the direct action that comes out of that. But, you know, his wand is destroyed as a result of that, and he has to do a lot of things to try to recover from that experience as well. It's just a profoundly important one. I really like how it connects him back, although it's a death experience, it connects him back to the world of the living in a really important way. I really love that point.
Yeah, and you know, this is the whole point of these experiences. You don't just forget about the death, but you forget a little. You have to forget just enough to be able to withstand the grief and be able to move on. And I think that's what that episode helps Harry realize.
Yeah, I don't remember if you talk about this in the article, but it also reminds me this lesson that you say is, you know, pretty prevalent in classical literature of, you know, the warning of indulging in too much grief. You know, this is really set out for them by the tale of the three brothers. And when they talk to Xenophilius Lovegood, and Hermione reads from the book that Dumbledore has left her about the different, you know, Deathly Hallows and what they do. And that stone is obviously rather dangerous, especially for somebody who's lost a loved one in grief. And so you can see that theme really clearly there. And then it seems like later, you know, in Godric's Hollow, Harry is, you know, helped with Hermione's help, is, you know, realizing that he can't indulge too much in this grief. A little bit is okay, but he has to be able to move on and remember that he's among the living, not the dead.
Memorialization is actually a really important part of being able to return to the land of the living. So it's a way to honor and remember the dead, but as you say, forget a little so that you can move on with the living and maybe in a new life.
Right. And in antiquity, you know, they had the games. And I don't know how many people in your audience know this, but the chariot races and so on and so forth, initially started as part of funeral celebrations. So you had, the funeral where you buried your dead, you indulge in your grief, you mourn them, but then you had a communal meal and followed by a series of games, and that, you know, healthy competition enhanced this idea of community among the living, first by the meal, of course, and then by the activity. And so you have, so in the Iliad, I don't know how many of you, again, in your audience have read the Iliad, but if you, you might have seen the movie. When Patroclus dies, the friend of Achilles, they have the funeral and then they have games. So it's a very, this importance of going back to the world of the living is extremely, an extremely important transition that people need to learn to accept and so that they can move on and they can actually, you know, survive the loss that they have happened to them.
Yeah, I like that tradition. I think we should bring that back. You heard it here first. Lily, your article really changed my thinking in some ways about the meaning of Dobby's burial and the way Harry buries Dobby. I have long thought of it as an allusion to another work that's really not that much older than the Aeneid, which is the Christian New Testament and the way Jesus washes the feet of his disciples the night before he dies and the night before he kind of sacrifices, you know, himself for them. And so I've always sort of interpreted it and what Harry kind of draws from that experience and the way he wants to do it without magic and sort of demean himself through it as an allusion to the gospel. But your article really helped me think of it, you know, maybe even the gospel events as sort of drawing on an older tradition. So tell us how you interpret Harry's burial of Dobby in light of Aeneas's experience of similar loss.
Well, I should say first that I don't think that there's one interpretation, right? I mean, I think I am completely in agreement with you that Christian New Testament narratives, Christian, obviously, the story of Christ and his sacrifice, all of that is hugely important for her. And she has said that herself. I mean, I'm not saying anything that's
right.
You know, that she herself has not said. And also she has said, as you both probably know, that a lot of the reason she wrote these books was to go through herself and you know, her mother's death, which was a very important moment in her life. And so a lot of, you know, that what the novels try to do is, you know, explore death, grief, all of these things. So I don't think that we can necessarily say it's either or. I would say both end is more the way I like to see it. For my purposes and because of my expertise, I could see it this one way. Obviously, there are other ways you could see it. But so let me, having said that, let me say that when a person goes to the underworld, they basically die, right? I mean, that's kind of like the obvious thing. You cannot go unless you actually die. So in ancient narratives, when the hero needs to die, like he can't die, right? He has to come back. And so in order for him to be able to go through the underworld, somebody else has to die. And there is this idea of exchange that occurs in ancient narratives that make it possible for our hero to come back. So, and again, this idea starts in the Odyssey, where Odysseus's helmsman dies. He actually drowns. And then he's the, you know, through him, Odysseus can actually go. And in the case of the Aeneid, because again, Virgil really draws from Homer and really has Homer in mind, especially in this part of his book and of his poem, Aeneas's helmsman dies. And in fact, there's a very interesting reduplication there, because he has two people that die. He has his helmsman, Palinurus, die, and then he also has this other comrade, Maecenas, die. And when Aeneas is at the entrance of the underworld, he meets the Sibyl, which is a prophetess. And the Sibyl says to him, you need to find this golden bough to get inside the underworld, but you cannot do anything. You cannot get in unless you bury your friend Maecenas, who lies unburied out there somewhere. And Aeneas is like, oh my God, you know, how am I going to find this dead guy, you know, and bury him? But he actually does come across him, and he performs the burial rites. And then lo and behold, he finds the golden bow and is able to get it. So Dobby, being this, you know, comrade of Harry, he is his sidekick, right? He is his helper. He adores him. He'll do anything for him. And of course, Harry, you know, has a great bond with him as well. There's no question about that. So when Dobby dies, when he, you know, sacrifices himself at Malfoy Manor, he is, and admittedly, and I know that this is a weak point in my argument, that this happens way before, you know, the forest and King's Cross. So it is a more, you know, it happens a lot earlier in the narrative of the Deathly Hallows than in the Aeneid, which happens like right as he is in the middle of going inside the underworld. When he gives himself, his friend, his comrade, Harry feels enormous amount of guilt, because I think Dobby is, you know, his surrogate. He does die in his place. And
mm-hmm, right.
When he decides he wants to bury him, and he wants to bury him, you know, with his hands, not with magic, he is doing that because he is, again, in the same, you know, terrible state of grief, where he needs to feel the pain physically. He needs to, take in the mortality that he has as human. And his anger, which is also part of his grief, they feed into each other. During that time, I should say, he also has a kind of an epiphany. He realizes that he shouldn't be angry, right? This is the first moment in the whole of the seven books that he realizes that anger is not something he should indulge in, that he should control it. And it's the first time he actually does control it after he has performed the burial. And he is thinking about the future. And right after that burial scene happens, he says, Horcruxes, not Hallows, right? And that major moment where he realizes that he can no longer, he doesn't care about the, you know, power and all the great things that the Hallows represent, but he needs to destroy the Horcruxes and rid the world of Voldemort. So this is the first moment he's a leader.
Right.
He becomes a leader.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he realizes even that his own survival may not be possible and is not his priority, you know. And I think that's the one of the biggest takeaways for him, is that this may require his own sacrifice, and that's going to be okay.
Yeah. And Lily, you do such a nice job in the article of talking about how, like, Harry, as he's digging, like, he's in the grave himself, right? As he's going, he's making the catabasis. He's descending in a way into that grave himself that he's digging for Dobby, which I thought was just a very powerful point.
Right. He is trying to join the world of the dead. And I have to say that this, again, my training as a classicist and having read so many narratives about mourning, one of the first wishes the mourner express is to wish to have been dead like their loved one. And so Harry, by digging, you know, the grave and going inside himself, is, you know, is getting to the closest you could get, right, in fulfilling that wish, short of dying. And in antiquity, they also visibly did this. You have, you know, in the ancient world, they would wash and anoint the body and, you know, put perfumes and, you know, make it very beautiful. But the mourners themselves were dirty. They would throw dirt on them or ash. They would dishevel their hair. They would, you know, disfigure themselves by clawing with their nails on their face and, you know, hitting their breasts with their fists. So you had a kind of reversal. The dead body looked, you know, more, you know, like almost like asleep. And then the living bodies were disfigured as if they were the dead body, right? Like if they were disfigured by death. So I think, and again, having read a lot of those texts helped me, when I read this episode, I thought, oh my God, this is what he's doing. He's disfiguring himself. He is burying himself. He's grieving. He's a mourner.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Dobby looks as if he could be sleeping, right? Isn't that what Luna
right.
says?
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you also see a parallel for the golden bough in the Deathly Hallows. How do you read that in to what's happening in that last book?
You know, the Elder Wand and the whole story behind it, it reminded me of the very, you know, famous story of the King of the Wood. For the King of the Wood myth goes as follows. There is this sacred grove in outside of Rome where a golden branch grows out of a tree, and the ruler there, the sort of, you know, the person that reigns there is a priest king. This priest king is happily ruling there until another person comes and snatches the branch, breaks it, and kills him. And so the person who has the branch and, you know, and kills the previous ruler gets to rule the grove. So the wands, you know, the way the wands work in Harry Potter reminded me of this myth. The parallels obviously were, you know, were very clear. You know, the way, again, Rowling has said in interviews and in other publications that she had researched the wands extensively. And I know that there she included elements from other mythical traditions, not classical, not Greco-Roman. But again, this idea of the king, you know, the holder of one wand killing the other to have the power, that is very much part of that same idea that is, you know, expressed in this myth of the King of the Wood.
Yeah, and the tale of the three brothers seems very similar in that. Yeah,
absolutely. And so when I was, you know, again thinking about this, and the golden bough is the talisman that Aeneas needs to find in order to go to the underworld. The Sibyl, as I said, the prophetess that meets him at the entrance, tells him that he needs to find it, otherwise he can't go there. And just like the wands have a certain kind of consciousness, so the golden bough is described as having that kind of consciousness, that it kind of chooses to go along with the person who tries to break it. That if it doesn't want to go, the Sibyl says, nobody can, you know, no force can actually make it go. And so that is very parallel. Now, one of the things I would say is that, that I should explain for your audience, is that the King of the Wood myth is linked with the Aeneid through a 4th century CE commentator named Servius. Servius wrote a commentary, which means a book that explains, you know, passages that are difficult to understand in the Aeneid. And when he reaches the book 6 of the Aeneid, where the golden bough appears, Servius tells us that this is the same golden bough that the king of the wood, has to get in order to rule the wood. This is a kind of crazy connection that Servius makes, and actually the ancients were really crazy with their connections. They're kind of fun like that.
They should have had a podcast.
Yes, I tell you, they are so funny that way. However, that connection was seized upon by a man named Fraser, who is the modern founder of anthropology and who wrote this humongous work of comparative anthropology, basically, where he collected all these myths. And he starts with this one. Through that connection, the golden bough, the king of the wood, and Virgil have been connected in our modern consciousness. That kind of helps Rowling bring those those two elements, the wand and the snitch, together, the golden yes. snitch and the yes. elder wand, brings them together and makes them as the talisman to be able to go to the underworld.
Yeah, because of course the golden snitch is, this is where Harry is able to, we've got the resurrection stone that then is able to, bring Harry into this kind of legion of heroes lost, or his parents and their friends, as he's walking into the forest at the end.
And the snitch is this puzzle he has to solve throughout the whole Deathly Hallows. You know, he doesn't mm-hmm. know what triggers it and what opens it, but it's, so he riddles it out. And yeah, as you said, like the dead come to fetch him, right, when he's ready to go, into the underworld.
And the golden snitch is shares a lot with the golden bough in the sense that they're both both animate and inanimate. So it's, they're gold, they're metal, but they're also have a consciousness. So mm-hmm. remember, the snitch has engraved on it, "I open at the close." So it has an eye, it has a certain subjectivity. And then it also communicates with Harry. When Harry decides that he's going to die, then it opens and brings the people back. So the golden snitch has a lot of parallels with the golden bough in the sense that it has, it is both metal and has a consciousness because it has inscribed on him, "I open at the close." And the golden bough itself, as the symbol says to Aeneas, needs to agree to go with the leader. And with whoever it is that, tries to break him, that otherwise they will never break. I should say here as an aside that Virgil complicates the pattern by having Aeneas break it off, although the bough does resist him. And this is a huge problem for readers of the Aeneid. And there's so much written about what that means. But thankfully for us, Rowling does not create any problems for Harry when he decides to when he actually gets it and it opens, and it symbolizes this liminal position that Harry occupies, he's both living and dead, like the snitch is both metal and living at the same time. So it it symbolically occupies that position that Harry occupies.
And that's so cool. And I love how the golden bough then has these kind of reference points in both the Elder Wand and the Resurrection Stone. And I wonder, do you see any corollary in the Aeneid for the last of the Hallows, the invisibility cloak? Does Aeneas have an invisibility cloak of some kind?
he does sometimes. So in the ancient narratives, they didn't need to have an actual cloak. They had a god that surrounded them with a mist.
Oh, sweet.
Sometimes when he needed that, he might have been covered with some kind of mist. And actually, if you are also friends of Rick Riordan's novels, the mist is very much used in the Percy Jackson one.
Okay.
So he's using. Yeah. But I also think isn't the invisibility cloak could be a direct influence of the ring, you know, from the Tolkien.
Oh, sure.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she doesn't have to take it all from the Aeneid.
Right.
She's
right,
mixing and matching.
There's more in that compost heap.
Exactly. I think, and I think this idea of the threes, of course, is very, you know, it's very traditional. But yeah, she mixes and matches, which is what makes it fun, right? I mean, if it was obvious, then it wouldn't be fun.
And rich, right?
Oh,
good fodder for discussion.
Absolutely. What can we learn from comparing Aeneas' underworld journey to Harry's experience in King's Cross at the end of the Deathly Hallows, which is obviously, it's a kind of underworld experience there.
The King's Cross is a very important moment, right, in the Deathly Hallows. Harry meets a father figure, Dumbledore, who has been, you know, in essence, his only father figure, right, that he has known, him and Sirius, pretty much. And he gets guidance from him. He gets information from him. And he gets to see what his choices really are, either to stay there in King's Cross and hang out or to go back and face Voldemort. And this moment is so important for Harry's, you know, it comes at a very central, climactic, I should say, a climactic moment in the work. And so past, present, future kind of converge. Time kind of stands still. Harry is not, he doesn't have the scar, right? He's in this, you know, limbo state again, just like we were talking before. And there's an enormous amount of light there. And I think, again, the movie did it really well. I think it showed that, you know, airiness and light and the light that was there kind of giving it this otherworldly feel. And Harry there realizes his mission. He realizes how he should be a leader. That's where Dumbledore tells him, I cannot have done this. I could not. Power was always tempted me. But you are not corrupted by power. You do it because you have to. And you're a great leader as a result. So this is sort of a lesson in leadership that has been going on throughout the book. But this is the culmination of it, where Dumbledore really explains to Harry his mission. And there's also a rebirth experience going on there with, on the one hand, Harry being naked and, you know, having, you know, then going back to the world of the living. And, of course, the baby Voldemort, which is this disfigured, horrible, repulsive creature that a soul that is cannot be reborn or can never, you know, go back to that purity that is embodied by Harry.
That's so cool. And so cool to put that in the context of these other experiences of the underworld and, you know, conversations with the dead and, you know, and memorializing and all of that that we've been talking about as well. And I do think it's really fascinating that we come back to the idea of Harry leading everyone into, you know, a new age that will be better now that Voldemort's reign has been fully conquered.
Right. And I do want to say that again, the idea of collapsing time is a very Virgilian idea.
Okay.
Because Virgil in the underworld collapses the narrative framework with the the historical framework, and then points to an endless future of prosperity and, you know, and greatness that never ends. And similarly, this timelessness is important in that scene over there at King's Cross, where we don't really know where we are in point of time, and Harry, when he actually emerges from it and, you know, eventually conquers Voldemort, we know that it's the end. There's nothing that, you know, there's no more threat. There's no more struggle to be had. And I think that's that timelessness, that secure timelessness, is very important for the Harry Potter works as well.
And I'm going to say maybe this is yet another justification for that much hated epilogue. which I don't hate, but it seems to serve like a similar purpose in showing that, yeah, this is a new era, and there are new beginnings that are going to come out of it.
Yeah, we're an epilogue friendly podcast.
Yes, I actually think she said it. She had to do it because she didn't want to keep any doubt, you know, leave any doubt that it was over. Like, there was not going to be more Harry, you know, fighting Voldemort. And I think that was important for her.
And perhaps another reason why Cursed Child, you know, makes a mistake.
Yeah, I know.
You just forget that one. Yeah, we're not especially Cursed Child friendly, I would say.
No.
We're a mixed group on that.
My 10-year-old is working his way on his own through Harry Potter now, and he asked me this morning, he said, "Mom, is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child canon?" And I said, "Well, it depends on who you ask." And he said, "Well, what if we ask J.K. Rowling?" And I said, "Well, some people would say J.K. Rowling is not canon."
Oh, my gosh.
That's my official line.
You've gone meta with your son.
I have.
Yeah, my son calls the Cursed Child the fake one, which I think is hilarious. Totally unprompted.
So, Lily, it's great to have you on because, you know, you have such expertise with classics, and that always feels like it's a really important interpretive key for these works. But is there, among you and other classics scholars, is it all good when you see the classical literature sort of appropriated by works like Harry Potter, or are there ever like cringeworthy moments or lamentable, you know, usages in this kind of intertextual practice?
Oh, that's a great question. We are thrilled when people care about the stuff we love. You know, not many people do. So we're just happy with whatever, to be honest. I mean, there were a couple of times when I watched the movie Troy with, you know, the one with Brad Pitt. The way they did the ending was like a little bit cringeworthy for me, but there's always a trade-off. Like, if this can get people to read the Iliad, and, you know, we're like, okay, you know, bring it on. So absolutely. There's actually a whole branch of our field, a whole subfield in classics that's called reception. And it deals with precisely not just popular, but any type of re-engagement with classical literature, with specific texts or myths or motifs. And we study them, and we are grateful for them. And it's a great way to actually bring people into our field. I should say that I teach a class called When Odysseus Met Harry.
Oh, cool.
Neat.
I precisely want students to see the, you know, the plethora of allusions from popular writers have to classical work. So in that class, we read The Hunger Games. We read, you know, the C.S. Lewis, The Narnia. And we read the Percy Jackson. I have worked on the Percy Jackson novels as well. And I also have lately, and this is due to my daughter, who's a teenager, I have actually started thinking, and I have started a project on K-pop and how they use.
Wow.
So it's a lot of fun.
That's fascinating.
Who'd have thought?
Oh my gosh. So, and you know, one of the things that I think is really valuable, and I'm a historian, and although I'm mostly kind of early modern, of course, I teach world history, so you end up going way back. And one of the things I think is so valuable that literature offers, as well as history, is a real appreciation for the, you know, the consistency of human experiences, and that the kinds of experiences people were having way, way back, that we can actually empathize with them and we can understand it. And, you know, the idea of understanding grief by reading some of these really, really old texts that are struggling with and grappling with some of the same, you know, feelings that we might have, I just think is really powerful, you know, and binding together humanity across times.
Thank you. This is great. Yes, that's exactly what we hope to show to, you know, people today. And also to show them, you know, that a lot of the things that we think are, you know, normal maybe aren't, because ancient people didn't do them, and vice versa. And things that people did and we don't do are, you know, how people are the same and also how people are different. Mm-hmm. And I think there's great value in both the, you know, the proximity to antiquity, but also our distance from it.
Yeah, I definitely think that games after the funeral thing, there's something interesting about that.
Yeah, I know.
Why don't we do more of that? And now it's time for the Muggle News.
Time to check the Muggle News.
In this special segment, we are going to give you listeners some ideas about conferences or CFPs, calls for papers, that you might want to get involved with. And we're also going to talk about some upcoming events. At the top of the news today is an event we talk about a lot that is gearing up right now, the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yay!
It's being held October 15th to 16th of this year, 2021. And this year it's scheduled to be held both in person and virtually. So it's very accessible no matter where you are.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Everybody can join in. This is very fan friendly as well as academic friendly.
Oh, yeah.
And I love the mixing of people. And if you go in person, there are people who are dressed in their house robes and dressed like, you know, Dolores Umbridge.
Yeah. Yes.
our friend.
Sometimes unexpectedly so.
Brent Satterley. Yes. Absolutely. And so, but there are all kinds of fun that happens there. And they really do it upright. And it even looks a little bit like Hogwarts, I think.
Oh, St. Joseph Hall. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's great. Oh, Katie, you don't know how much I look forward to this, especially this year, since last year it was all virtual because of the pandemic. And I just missed it so much because this is my weekend. This is my weekend away. And it's my weekend. And the people that I have connected with at Chestnut Hill, including yourself.
Yes.
Your august self. You know, just all kinds of people who I just look forward to seeing every year and really have become some of my closest people.
Yes.
My friends in Potter.
Yeah, I met you there. And, you know, we also met Lori, our producer there, the beginning
Love
of,
it.
You know, wonderful partnerships.
Yeah.
Now, listeners, you can go to their website at www.harrypotterconference.com. So Harry Potter Conference is all one word. To get the latest information on the conference. And you can attend as an audience member just to soak up all the wonderful Potter scholarship. But if you're so inclined, you can also submit an abstract for a paper yourself. The deadline for submissions is September 6, 2021. So there's still time. You can do it.
Have you already submitted, Katie?
I have.
Yep, me too. Me too. I'm really looking forward to being there and it's all Potter all the time. It's great.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And it's just a wonderful forum for Potter studies and just great people. So check it out.
Yeah, and I will also just add that there's a lot of kind of first time presenters, I think, that present at Chestnut Hill. So I think if you've never done this thing before, but you've thought about it and kind of, you know, had an idea that you would like to present at a conference like this, this would be a good one to try. It's a very affordable conference as well. Very, very, I think the ticket price is like, I want to say $15. Is that about right?
Yes. And I think in previous years, the only reason it was a little higher, like $30, was because you were getting lunch in there too. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's definitely, it's accessible in all the ways. Those are two great points to make about it, Emily.
Yeah. A sister conference that we also love is the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference, sometimes referred to as SWPECA, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That has it's great. It has a specially designated Harry Potter studies section, kind of like a track. And it's all Harry Potter all the time. So it's kind of a special niche within the conference.
Yes. And, you know, they don't schedule Harry Potter papers against each other. It's just in that section, and you can go. And when I've gone in the past, I go and I'm just there. I'm in that room. I'm listening to all the Harry Potter papers. And it's just wonderful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I've only been able to go to the virtual version of the conference. Last year was my first year. But I actually got a ton out of this conference in terms of especially just listening to all the Potter scholarship, which was of a very high quality. And then I actually presented on Star Wars. So if you have other interests, they have other tracks as well in the conference. And so I was able to present in the Star Wars, which was part of the science fiction track of the conference. So it was really great. And I actually got a lot of great follow-up opportunities after that. So it's a little bit more expensive as conferences go, but in the end it was worth it to me.
Yeah. It's an academic conference, so it does have, you know, more of the academia vibe, but I also think that new voices are very much appreciated in that conference.
Yeah.
And although it's one of the regional popular and American culture conferences, it's not the national one. It's the only one that has this specially designated Harry Potter section. So if Harry Potter is your jam, this is really the place to go to deliver your paper. So I really highly recommend it.
Definitely. And they've already set the dates for 2022. And those dates are February 23 to 26. And again, that is 2022. They are also accepting abstract submissions for conference papers, and those are due by October 31st. Very auspicious for Harry Potter studies.
Yes.
October 31st, 2021. So get yours together soon if you're interested. You can check out the conference call for papers at southwestpca.org/conference/call-for-papers. And we can put those links in the show notes, I bet. Right,
yes,
Katie?
I think we probably can. Yes, indeed. Awesome. And, you know, I hope that you all will check out these events. They are wonderful places to meet people and to really talk with people who know Potter inside and out. And I know a lot of our listeners are really into that. So so definitely see about, you know, either attending or even participating as a you know, conference presenter at one of these two conferences. Now, if you know of a great magic festival or an upcoming conference that Potterversity listeners might want to know about, please let us know. If you have had a wonderful experience at a con of a various kind, tell us that too. We are really interested in hearing about the ways that Potter fans are making connections through a variety of these events, and we definitely want to be able to support these events and support that building of this, you know, this Potter Scholars community.
Don't forget to listen until the end of the episode for our social media handles and our email address.
And that's all for now, but stay tuned for more Muggle news in future episodes. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode today. Thank you, Dr. Lily Panucci, for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazingly fun.
Yeah, what a delightful conversation. I just had the best time. The quote for the end of today's episode describes Harry's epiphany as he digs Dobby's grave, a realization born out of his experience with death and sorrow. On Harry dug, deeper and deeper into the hard, cold earth, subsuming his grief and sweat, denying the pain in his scar. In the darkness, with nothing but the sound of his own breath and the rushing sea to keep him company, the things that had happened at the Malfoys returned to him. The things he had heard came back to him, and understanding blossomed in the darkness.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.